$1 million hit next year. Charleston won't have to do any major cuts this time around, but Littleford says if things don't improve, the district will have to look for new revenue and likely cut more programs. He says PE and fine art are on the table for the first time.
I've lost a lot of sleep. You get in this education business, you get into it to help children and to provide education to kids. And when you're not able to do it in the manner of which you've been able to do it, then it really causes some hardships for you.
Villa Grove and Charleston are just two examples, but state funding affects all districts statewide. Under the state funding formula, the minimum cost to educate students in Illinois is $6,119 per pupil. School districts are expected to cover what they can of that amount, and the state ideally picks up the rest of the tab. There is also an element called the poverty grant to provide more support for schools with low-income students. But in recent years, the state hasn't been able to pay the full amount that it owes schools. In fact, the state has only paid 89% of that amount this year, and based on Governor Quinn's budget proposal, it could be even lower next year. State Education Superintendent Christopher Cook says more cuts are not realistic, especially when schools are required to meet new mandates for teacher training and tougher standards for students in meeting math and reading goals.
We're trying to make a lot of really critical and necessary improvements, and we're doing it at a time when we've been seeing, you know, increased reductions in the budget, and that's why the board this year is saying that simply needs to stop.
Cook is urging lawmakers to raise education funding by $874 million for K-12 education, but Governor Quinn wants to cut about $308 million in order to deal with pension costs. As state officials argue over how much money should go to schools, districts are stuck in the middle, guessing over how much they have to cut. To balance its budget, the Decatur School District is getting rid of block scheduling at the middle and high schools and cutting 77 positions in a district serving more than 9,000 students. But business director Todd Kovalt says the decision was made without a clear picture of what the state funding will be.
Illinois requires that you provide notice, I believe it's 45 days before the end of the school term. We have to make the reductions now, even though we really don't have a complete understanding of how the finances are going to be for us next year, and probably won't know until school starts in the fall.
Unless the state finds a solution to its problems, Illinois schools will likely face more challenges, complicated by the looming effects of the federal sequester and drops in revenue from local property taxes. I'm Sean Powers, Illinois Public Media.
And if you'd like to see more of Sean's coverage of the public school system and all of our coverage on education issues in Illinois, visit us online at will.illinois.edu. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine. Yesterday on the show, we aired part one of an interview that Michelle O'Neill did with Ron Brooks. Ron says that to get rid of Asian carp, he wants to, quote, eat them and export them. He's the head of Kentucky's Fisheries Division, and he says it'll take a combination of help from the governments, fishing companies, and the restaurant industry to eliminate what he sees as a parasite. As one of the first steps, his department hosted a Carp Madness tournament last week. Michelle O'Neill continues her conversation with Brooks.
See, the problem that, you know, the fish and wildlife have across the state, fish and wildlife have across the board, is that we're all funded mostly with sport fish money. And so there are rules attached to that from the federal excise taxes that say we cannot directly go after Asian carp because they're not a sport fish species. So our hands are kind of tied. We're able to put some of our folks on the water to help these tournaments, but most of the prize money is going to have to come from the public sector. So we're really hoping for these donations.
So really you need more companies that are interested in exporting the fish?
You know, we have the markets. There's fish meal markets. There are like this export market that I just told you about. There's two of those in Illinois. The infrastructure just isn't large enough to meet the market demand. Right now fish meal is insatiable, but we don't have the industry in place that can handle the volume of fish that need to come in to make that profitable. And they got to have a system where, you know, I don't know if you were there or not, but they had boatloads of these things, and they can't haul those things very far in their boats. So they got to have a trucking system where somebody can be there like we were with the reefer trucks and stuff, so they can put them right on the trucks and you know, get rid of them as quickly as they can. Economically, Kentucky, Tennessee, most of the southern states now with the populations the way they are, can actually come out ahead if they just give the industry just a single push from a little help from the governments, both federal and state, you know, I think this thing would just take off. The domestic market is increasing tremendously. I mean, we've had some samples. We had a Chef Parola that came up from Louisiana and was fixing some during that second day of the tournament. We were fixing samples of Asian carp both days. Everybody that tried it walked away satisfied, thinking this is a great tasting fish. And it is.
And how did it get to be that they were, you know, so reviled by people as something that Americans would not eat?
Well, everything pretty much that comes from China in terms of fish, when you do a translation, it's a carp. So everybody associates Asian carp with the common carp. Common carp are very, very musky, fishy taste. You know, you got to acquire a taste for those fish. Those are bottom feeders. These fish don't feed off the bottom. In the water column, they're in the upper part of the water column where their diet is. Their diet is phytoplankton and zooplankton, and those things stick to the near the surface of the water. So they're not anywhere close. That also makes them not only nutritious, but it also makes them very, very low in contaminants because, you know, most of the contaminants settle to the bottom where your bottom feeders go. You know, it's a great fish all the way around. Unfortunately, we're calling them Asian carp. You know, the guy in Louisiana, Chef Parola, calls them silverfin. And there's a lot, if you look at history, they've started changing to the cods and stuff and call them different names than they were in the past so people wouldn't associate them with those lower quality fish. I guess we could do that. You know, we could call them silverfin or we can call them what their common name is. A common name for bighead is speckled Amur. And, you know, I guess if I was sitting in front of in a restaurant and had a, you know, the itinerary in front of me or and I saw a speckled Amur, I'd be interested to see how that tasted, especially if the waiter came out and said, oh, it's a beautiful tasting fish, you know, because they are. And I imagine you'll hear more about silverfin and speckled Amur pretty soon because we're going to go on a campaign to get more people interested in these things and more restaurants and chefs interested in these things. It's going to be kind of a major emphasis by our fisheries division in the next 9 months. So.
And what about the Mississippi River? I mean, do you think fishing and overfishing for a while would thin them out there too?
Yes, I tell you, if we had a domestic market started where the fishermen could get paid 20 to 30 cents a pound for these things, as many of them as are out there from Arkansas to Iowa now, fishermen would go after those things in a heartbeat. All they want to do is get compensated. They understand also that this is a detriment to the ecology, to the aquatic environment, and that threatens their livelihood as well. So they want these things out of there as much as we do. And I'm going to tell you something. If you give the commercial industry impetus without regulatory action, they'll overfish anything, and that's the beauty of it. And that's what we want.
Ron Brooks of the Kentucky Fisheries Director on how to get rid of Asian carp, and that was him speaking with reporter Michelle O'Neill. To see part one of that conversation, you can visit our site, will.illinois.edu, and that's also where you can find all of our interviews and features from the Afternoon Magazine. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Radio.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store. Strawberry Fields offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, and pet foods. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
Listening to WILL AM 580.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 2nd of April, 2013. It's the birthday of Hans Christian Andersen, born in Odense, Denmark, 1805, son of an illiterate mother, a poor cobbler. He trained for the ballet, the stage, and the opera, but when all of that failed, he settled on becoming a poet. His first novel got him enough success he was able to afford to travel, which would become his lifelong passion. He left Denmark on 30 different trips, spending 20 years abroad, traveling as far as Constantinople. He was a fine promoter of himself, and he befriended practically everyone of importance in Europe, musicians and scientists, politicians, royalty, artists. He wrote 6 novels, several travel books, 35 plays, and 175 fairy tales, including The Little Mermaid, The Princess and the Pea, The Emperor's New Clothes, Thumbelina, The Ugly Duckling. And he remained forever true to his humble beginnings. He believed that status should be the right of everyone and not the privilege of the aristocracy. It's the birthday of Giacomo Casanova, born in Venice, 1725, the famous libertine. He was a compulsive gambler, restless man, earned a law degree. He was secretary to a cardinal in Rome. He joined the military, played violin in the theater, translated the Iliad, spied for the government, was a librarian, and seduced many women, which he wrote about in his 12-volume autobiography, The Story of My Life. It came to 3,500 pages. Casanova, who wrote, "I loved, I was loved, my health was good, I had a great deal of money, and I spent it, I was happy, and I confessed it to myself." And it's the birthday of the novelist Émile Zola, born in Paris, 1840, who tried to apply scientific principles of observation to writing fiction. Émile Zola, who said, "One forges one's style on the terrible anvil of daily deadlines. The artist is nothing without the gift, but the gift is nothing without work." Here's a poem for today by Stephen Dunn, "Briefcases." 15 years ago, I found my father's in the family attic, so used the shoemaker had to repair it, and I kept it like love until it couldn't be kept anymore. Then my father-in-law died, and I got his, almost identical, just the wrong initials, embossed in gold. It's 40 years old, falling apart. Soon there'll be nothing that smells of father love